From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning. I'm David Berg. Coming up, a NATO airstrike kills five Afghan soldiers. A UN official calls for more human rights in Sri Lanka. And how did television change one young boy's life in Bhutan? These and more on this Friday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. A NATO airstrike killed five Afghan soldiers and wounded at least 17 others early Thursday in the eastern province of Logar. A spokeswoman for the U.S.-led international forces in Afghanistan said the troops were killed accidentally during a military operation. She said an investigation is ongoing to determine the cause of the incident and sent condolences to the families of those killed. Speaking during a visit to Sri Lanka, Afghan President Hamid Karzai said his government is also investigating the incident and welcomes NATO's apology.
We are investigating the nature of this attack on Afghan troops, where unfortunately five or four soldiers lost their lives. This attack NATO has admitted to and has said that they did it mistakenly. We will investigate the issue. And then speak about it. But it's a sad event. We have lost five or four soldiers apparently a mistaken NATO attack.
The NATO-led coalition said soldiers were accidentally bombed during an operation intended to support Afghan security forces in the province. They were mistaken for insurgents. It said that NATO aircraft engaged suspected insurgents on a ridge overlooking Nawar village, adding the victims were later identified as Afghan Army soldiers. The strike comes during a low point in ties between the United States and Mr. Karzai, who has criticized airstrikes that kill Afghans. U.S. officials say if the Afghan president does not agree soon to a long-delayed deal on a lasting American military presence, all U.S. troops will be pulled from the country in December. Meanwhile, Afghan President Karzai's brother has dropped out of the April 5th presidential race and is urging his supporters to back former Foreign Minister Zalmay Rasool in the election. From Islamabad, Ayaz Gul reports that observers believe the political move is part of President Karzai's strategy to boost his preferred successor.
Qayyum Karzai, the elder brother of the incumbent president, told reporters in Kabul that after consulting elders in 28 of the 34 Afghan provinces, he has decided to quit the presidential race in favor of the former foreign minister. He described his team as an essential part of the new alliance. He said he requests all respected religious scholars, tribal elders and Afghan youth to fully back Zalmay Rasool to ensure that Afghanistan is able to sustain gains it has made over the past 12 years and the country can be guided towards achieving lasting peace, stability and economic development, and a repeat of the bitter experiences of the past can be prevented. Presidential candidate Rasool, sitting next to Qayyum Karzai, welcomed the announcement. He said that his strong team, with the help of friends and support of the people, will emerge the winner in next month's elections. Qayyum Karzai's exit leaves 10 candidates in the race, including opposition politician Abdullah Abdullah, runner-up of the fraud-riddled 2009 presidential polls, and Ashraf Ghani, who has served as former finance minister under President Karzai's administration. The Afghan constitution bars Mr. Karzai from running for a third consecutive term, and he has vowed not to publicly endorse any candidate to strictly maintain his neutrality in the election. But critics see Thursday's move as a signal that Zalmay Rasool is the incumbent president's preferred choice. Political analysts in Kabul suggest that Mr. Karzai appears to be striving for an influential background role after his presidential term ends. Syed Azam is a former election official and political commentator in Kabul.
He has tried to create a kind of atmosphere, a kind of scenario that makes his desired candidate to be the absolute winner and a winner of the election just in the first round.
Voting on April 5th could be followed by a runoff election between the two leading candidates, with a new president finally being chosen in June or July. The election will mark the first democratic transfer of power in the history of the war-ravaged nation. Observers say that President Karzai's refusal to sign a bilateral security agreement with the United States to extend the American military mission in Afghanistan beyond 2014 could be part of his election strategy to win public support for his favored candidate. Analyst Azam says all prominent presidential candidates, including Zalmay Rasool, supported signing the security deal with the U.S.
I think the main reason is the election. I think, you know, once President Karzai see, you know, that the outcome of the election is in his own favor, and that his desired candidate will be his successor, even after the election, he will still be the president, and he will sign it.
The standoff over the security agreement has strained bilateral ties, while President Karzai has also launched regular verbal assaults on the U.S.-led coalition's counterterrorism activities in Afghanistan and civilian casualties in these operations. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
You're listening to VOA's Daybreak Asia. Like what you hear? Be sure to check out our Facebook page. Our address is VOA Asia. You can like us on Facebook and leave your questions or comments. Coming up, Ray Kugel tells us how the advent of electricity and television changed the lives of people in a remote Himalayan village. Rights activists and the International Commission of Jurists say that Thailand needs to be held to greater account for its human rights record, especially in cases of forced disappearances and extrajudicial abuses. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok.
Human rights lawyers say Thailand has to be held accountable for its human rights record as the country bids for key posts on the UN Human Rights Council and as a non-permanent member of the Security Council. Human rights abuse charges include actions of security forces in the ongoing violence in southern Thailand, which has claimed more than 5,000 lives since 2004, together with alleged forced disappearances, killing, torturing, and abuse of criminal suspects. A report from US-based Human Rights Watch notes the failure by Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra's government to be held accountable for past abuses as a leading trigger for the anti-government protests in Bangkok that have claimed more than 20 lives. The protests followed a government-backed amnesty bill covering acts of violence, abuse and corruption. The bill was seen as favouring Ms. Yingluck's older brother, former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who lives overseas to avoid a jail term for corruption. Human Rights Watch senior researcher Sunay Pasuk says Thailand must address its human rights record before getting backing for key UN posts.
This is Thailand that is now applying for a seat at the UN Human Rights Council, at the UN Security Council. I don't think the country deserves that status at all. If it continues to believe in lawlessness, if it continues to believe in impunity instead of justice, accountability and respect for human rights.
The Thai government has consistently defended its adherence to human rights standards at international forums and the United Nations. The concerns come as the family of Muslim human rights lawyer Somchai Nilapaichit marks 10 years since he was abducted in Bangkok in March 2004 and feared murdered. Senior police officers were initially detained over Somchai's abduction, but judges dismissed most charges against suspects for insufficient evidence. One suspect on bail has since disappeared. Somchai's wife, Ankana Nilapaichit, told reporters how she has continued the fight to find those responsible for her husband's disappearance.
Even though the justice process may not bring his life back, but it should not be allowed to avoid the responsibility to give justice back to Somchai. In the past 10 years, I have tried very hard to achieve justice. The Yingluck government has given me compensation, but the money cannot restore the dignity of the victim.
A daughter of Somchai, Pratubchit Nilapaichit, a lawyer and advocate, says she remains hopeful the case will be solved, as her father always had faith in truth and justice.
As a human rights activist, we have to be optimistic, right? We always believe and we always have hope because we believe that the power of people have, you know, been very strong day by day. So we believe that one day we might find justice and, you know, truth about this case one day.
International Commission of Jurists Asia and Pacific Region Regional Director Sam Zarifi says Somchai's case is a highlight for international concerns over enforced disappearances.
That Somchai's case has come to become a symbol for the problem of enforced disappearances, not just in Thailand or Southeast Asia, but really around the world. This is, at this point, one of the emblematic cases of enforced disappearance in the world.
Thailand has agreed to recognize the UN Convention on Forced Disappearances, but has yet to sign the treaty. ICJ's Zam Zarifi says once the treaty is signed, Thailand will face greater accountability for its human rights performance. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Still with human rights, the top UN human rights official is calling for independent international investigations into violations in Ukraine and Sri Lanka. As Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, Navi Pillay said the Sri Lankan government has still not answered lingering questions about human rights abuses nearly 5 years after the end of its war with the Tamil Tigers.
This was Navi Pillay's final annual report to the UN Human Rights Council before stepping down as High Commissioner for Human Rights in August. She reflected with pride upon the accomplishments of her office during her six-year tenure, but expressed sorrow for the many challenges and implacable brutality that caused so much grievous suffering around the world. Pillay spoke about the need to strengthen accountability and about the dangers of allowing states and individuals to commit gross human rights violations with impunity.
Nearly 5 years on from the end of the conflict in Sri Lanka, I regret that the government has failed to satisfy the Council's call for a credible and independent investigation into allegations of serious human rights violations. I am therefore recommending that the time has come for the Council to establish its own international inquiry mechanism, which I believe can play a positive role where domestic mechanisms have failed.
The Sri Lankan government has rejected an international inquiry into possible war crimes by government forces and separatist Tamil Tigers during a 26-year civil war. The Sinhalese government accuses Pillay, who is a South African of Tamil ancestry, of being biased, an accusation she denies. Pillay also raised concerns about protecting human rights in the context of counterterrorism and armed drones. She spoke with particular passion about the harm caused by discrimination to people all around the world. She described the work of her office in trying to help victims of sexual violence and armed conflict in Central African Republic, Colombia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Somalia. She urged nations not to forget the unspeakable violations occurring in Syria and North Korea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's Daybreak Asia. Amid recent clashes over trade and diplomatic issues, a senior American official visiting New Delhi says the United States remains committed to boosting its partnership and business ties with India. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the U.S. diplomat called for dialogue to resolve differences which range from intellectual property to trade protection.
As U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asia, Nisha Biswal, wrapped up her visit to India, she said the countries are tackling their differences head-on. Biswal said the solution is to talk and to trade. She outlined U.S. concerns over market barriers in India in a speech in New Delhi.
We are concerned that domestic content requirements here are discouraging investment into India, inhibiting innovation, and holding India back from developing into the world-class manufacturing sector that it needs to be in order to compete and generate jobs for millions of Indian youth that are entering the job market.
U.S. businesses complain Indian rules discriminate against American exports. The main friction relates to India's fast-growing solar energy sector, in which New Delhi has mandated local sourcing rules, triggering complaints of discrimination by the U.S. industry. India says its rules are compliant with international law. The dispute is headed to the World Trade Organization. That has raised worries the disputes are deepening the clouds over a relationship which has yet to recover from a rough patch following the December arrest and strip search of an Indian diplomat in New York. Biswal is the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit India since then. She spoke of red tape and a lack of transparency in Indian tax laws. Biswal called for India to strengthen protection of intellectual property, another issue American companies have been pushing, especially for production of drugs under patent protection. In New Delhi, she struck a conciliatory note, saying the U.S. is focused on its partnership with India and wants to grow trade fivefold over the next decade.
We want to work with India, trade with India, invest in India, innovate with India, and grow with India. And I assure you, we're committed to cooperation and ambition in our ties with India.
But analysts say the relationship will take time to recover, and the direction the two democracies are headed in remains uncertain until a new government is elected in India by mid-year. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
We head to the movie theater, as we do at this time each week. It is hard to imagine any place without television. But not too long ago, the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan, lodged between China and India, was one such location. Daybreak Asia's Ray Kugel tells us about a new documentary showing how one young boy's yearning for TV was finally answered in an extraordinary way.
In 1999, the King of Bhutan made it official. He decreed that television could become part of everyday life as part of the country's modernization and development. More than a decade later, electric lines were just beginning to appear in the small agrarian mountain village of Leya, 4,000 meters high. A documentary called Happiness looks at the change it brings to an 8-year-old Buddhist monk named Pianki and the family life around him. The young boy is sent to a monastery because his mother can no longer afford school. Pianki accepts it grudgingly and eagerly awaits visits home, where he thoroughly enjoys the boyhood pleasures of running and playing in the fields with his friends. It is a 3-day journey Pianki takes to the capital of Thimphu with his uncle, who sells a yak for 200 euros to buy a television set that opens the boy's eyes to flickering images he's never seen. More than a sense of wonder over city lights, cars, and noise, it is watching American professional wrestling on television that entrances Pianki and, later, the other villagers' first viewing experience back in Leya. The film offers a fascinating perspective of technology's march into Bhutan and the changes it makes to a remote society that's managed quite well without it. Happiness director Tomas Balmes, who is based in Paris, provides a stunningly visual story with a narrative to match. I talked with Balmes about why he chose Bhutan and followed an engaging young monk to make the documentary.
I had heard about the fact that this was one of the only countries in the world to ban television for a long time. I always felt that this could be an interesting subject. Very quickly, when I arrived in the village, by pure accident, in the middle of one of my treks in the middle of the village, I just saw this little boy who just was very special. He was just jumping and dancing and running and doing crazy things all the time. There was something very joyful and also very sad in him, which attracted me very quickly.
As a documentary, did you write the story and look for actors or find a family first and tailor your story around them?
The way it's crafted and the way it's shot and the way it's edited and the way it's framed and everything, I made it with a big intention of to look like fiction. But everything you see is pure reality. So what I was really looking for is a potential character who could hold on a story and having on the background my story of television and the arrival of television being there. But I really wanted to have the human story first. And having this young boy going through all these different phases and all these different first-time events, I felt it could be enough to have him as a main character.
Did you face any major obstacles in the filmmaking because of the country?
Apart from this financial aspect, this is a very cooperative country and very easy. Apart from the big difficulties to reach the place, we had to travel over 2 days with horses, generators, bring everything we were using over the next 3 weeks, food, oil, electricity, everything we had to provide and bring on horses. So in terms of logistics, this was very complicated. But apart from that, this is a very safe and very pleasant country.
Is there any significance to the final scene in the film of a family being mesmerized while watching professional wrestling on television, which is not real to begin with?
Among the 50 channels which were offered to Bhutan, the most successful one for months and months have been the American wrestling one. This was like watched in such big amount of time, like 13, 14 hours a day, that many people in the country, in the government, thought that this might be damaging, potentially dangerous for people to just watch that.
Are you making a statement in the film about television's influence on society in terms of modern versus undeveloped?
I don't. I only think that this can maybe potentially raise some discussions. Some discussions among families about the relationship they have with television, and some discussions among politicians, which it already started in Bhutan, about what kind of content do we want to have on television.
Do you think an Asian audience and a Western audience would view this film differently?
I definitely do think so. You know, I think every country has a kind of a relationship to things. And I think everybody in the world should go and live things and then understand things and maybe have a different opinion after having experimenting things.
Balmes's documentary recently received the World Cinema Documentary Award for cinematography. Happiness is not just a spectacular viewing experience, but also a thought-provoking piece of work about the long reach of television. Whether it truly brings happiness is, very much like beauty, in the eye of the beholder. I'm Ray Kugel.
And VOA's Ray Kugel joins us every Friday to tell us about a movie with an Asian theme. A human rights group says that Vietnam has the highest number of political prisoners in Southeast Asia. The International Federation for Human Rights says at least 212 Vietnamese dissidents are behind bars, and many more are under house arrest. A Malaysian court has begun a hearing, a government appeal against the sodomy acquittal of opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim. Sodomy is punishable by up to 20 years in prison under a colonial-era law in Malaysia. Thank you for joining us today on VOA's Daybreak Asia. I'm David Byrd. Stay tuned for the latest world news on International Edition coming up on many of these same frequencies. Join us again Monday at this same time for another edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page.